Hello, and welcome to the Needs Improvement Podcast, your regular deep dive into reimagining mental health and well-being in the workplace. I'm your host, Nicholas Whitaker, coach and co-founder of the Changing Work Collective. In every episode, we sit down with thought leaders in organizational health, as well as individuals who've navigated the complexities of mental health, well-being, and belonging in the workplace. Our goal? To dismantle the stigma surrounding mental health, ignite meaningful dialogue, and inspire both employees and leaders to revolutionize the way performance is gauged at work. So if you're eyeing a healthier, happier chapter in your professional life, you're in the right place. Together, let's transform the places we work into the places we would love to be. Let's dive into what needs improvement. Well, hey, folks, welcome back to another episode of the Needs Improvement Podcast. I'm here with Dr. Nate Regeer. Nate, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and say hello to our audience?
Nick, it's so great to be here with you, and thank you. I've been looking forward to this conversation. Yeah, for those that don't know me, I'm Nate Regeer. I'm the CEO and one of the founding partners of Next Element Consulting. We're a global leadership consulting and development firm that helps people transform their cultures with compassionate accountability. We've been doing this for 15 years. We are starting our 16th year of business trying to bring more compassion to the world. And I couldn't be more excited to be here. I'm so excited about this year.
Oh, that's so cool. And Nate, you've got a book, Compassionate Accountability, that I had the pleasure of getting my hands on early last year. And I have to say, it's one of those books that you kind of pick up and you can't put down. I took it with me camping a few different times. I took it with me to a couple of trips to Mexico just to make sure that I was like getting as much as I possibly could out of that book. And I have to say, like, it really hit me hard, like just some of the descriptions that you had about the role of compassion within corporate spaces over the years, compassion and accountability across the workplace. But yeah. I wonder, you know, could you tell us a little bit about what does compassion and accountability actually mean? There's almost, I think a lot of people think of those as like competing, conflicting terms or ideas.
Yeah, you know, it is one of those phrases. We coined this phrase about 10, 12 years ago. And when we started just saying it, people would have two reactions. The first one is like puzzlement. Like, what do you mean? Those aren't supposed to, why are you putting those together? They don't go like that. And then after it would sink in, there would be this sense of what if? And I know one thing that you and I share is a passion for bringing more compassion to the workplace and seeing the experiences of what culture, what happens when we don't bring it in and why it's so important. And so when coming up to COVID, pandemic has been such a transformative kind of mind-bending, mind-altering, mindset-shifting event for so many of us. But one of the things we realized coming out of it was that compassion and accountability cannot be separated, and that creating an artificial dichotomy, like the two are somehow in tension with each other, like you have to choose. Not only does it misunderstand what compassion means, but that's a forced choice that's artificial, and we just don't need to make it. So what we've concluded over many years of working in companies and leaders is that compassion includes accountability, and you can't have one without the other. And if you try, there's predictable negative consequences. And so we need to strive to make both true without compromise in every interaction.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's dive into that a little bit more, because I know that you have this kind of concept of different switches being flipped in order to be able to really have compassion and accountability show up effectively within the workspace. Tell us a little bit about that and like what that actually means.
Yeah, the visual or the metaphor of switches is that you think about electrical switches on your wall. You know, they control the flow of energy, and the energy is always there just waiting. And when the switch is turned on, energy flows and it powers all the amazing things in our house, from our lights to our blender that we make those awesome smoothies in the morning to, you know, whatever. But when the switches are off, the energy is blocked. It doesn't mean there's no energy. It's just not being utilized to make light in the world. And when we were trying to identify or define what really is compassion and looking at how we misunderstand it and how we've kind of, I think, really not leveraged the potential in the whole concept of compassion, what we realized is that compassion is three things. It is treating ourselves and each other as valuable human beings, but it's also treating each other and others as capable. We are agentic human beings that come with all these gifts and skills and passions and desires to solve problems and create in the world. But it's not just that. You know, as humans working in community, we are also accountable to each other. So responsibility for our behaviors, for our thoughts and feelings, and how we show up in community has to be part of compassion. It's not just being nice to each other or kind. And so that concept of value, capability, and responsibility, we felt had to be incorporated into a working definition of compassion. So the switches seemed like we'd have a switch for each one of these. And then we started to identify how could you turn that switch on through your mindset, your behaviors, your thoughts, your feelings, and live that out in every interaction.
Wow, that makes a ton of sense. And I imagine too, like this is probably like a bit of a new concept for a lot of folks. Like I said, like I think even myself, you know, there was this kind of assumption over the years that you can lean into compassion or you can lean into performance or accountability, but like to really have both of those things at the same time, it requires like a lot of struggle. But yeah, after reading your book and kind of thinking about this as like different levers you can pull or switches that you can flip, it sounds more, it's more like a toolkit that you can use. You can apply to different situations depending on what that situation needs in order to get the best possible result.
Absolutely. I love that you use the word toolkit and use the word lever, because compassion can't just be a concept. It can't just be a feeling. It can't just be, oh, my heart goes out to you and I want to alleviate the suffering. We have to have practical, operational, measurable skill sets that we can teach people, and then we can watch it happen in a culture and implement it. So our goal has been to scale compassion. You mentioned that in your introduction, and you can't scale something unless you can operationalize it, repeat it, teach it, measure it. And so that's been our goal, is to be able to do that.
And then how does that work in practice? So I imagine that you've been, you know, talking mm-hmm. about this quite a bit since you wrote your book, and you're also working with different teams and leaders to put this in, to operationalize this within organizations. Yeah. Where do you see this really successful? Where do people struggle? Where do you see people struggle yeah. with this?
Well, we have a ton of experience over the years bringing this into companies, but more specifically, we're really starting to nail down now what are the core components that have to be included. And first of all is the mindset. Mindset precedes behavior. Mindset is so critical that we can choose our mindset. We can decide how we want to think about things. And so mindset comes first, and that's where the three switches are all about. But then comes the skill set. And skill set means we have to now learn the behaviors to make this a reality. And so we've created a system for teaching people how to engage in interactions while keeping all three switches on. And it's a template called ORPO that we teach, open, resourceful, persistent, open. And it's a behavioral communication technique that says, okay, there's conflict, there's challenge. We got to deal with something. We have bad news to break, whatever it is. How are we going to do it with our switches on? And how are we going to mm-hmm. guarantee that we are able to have that conversation or design that policy or refine that procedure to affirm value, capability, and responsibility? And so that's where we introduce the template and kind of the way of having conversations. Then we can back up and say, okay, so now let's look at our policies and procedures through this lens. You know, I was working with an executive team the other day, and they brought their mission, vision, values, and they brought their core values to the table. And we said, now let's look at these. A, do they support all three switches? Or are you maybe compromising one in favor of another? And then B, how are you operationalizing that in your daily practices and procedures? That was a really eye-opening experience for them. But it starts with, you can't just have values. You have to live them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I wonder too, because like in part of your book and towards the beginning of the book, there's this bit of a breakdown of like the changing nature of compassion within the workplace over the decades.
Yeah.
And I think in my own experience, and it was interesting the way that your book charted that period of time, it really reflected the period in time that I was in corporate America. You know, I came in right at the beginning yeah. of a lot of those conversations around compassion, implementing compassion. And it seemed to be a lot of value statements and talking about these principles, but yeah. when the rubber actually hit the road, things didn't quite necessarily work yeah. correctly. And I'm kind of curious, like what you've seen in terms of the evolution of that over the years and how that's changed. And maybe if you could bring us up to speed in terms of like where things yeah. are at now in this kind of like quasi post-COVID yeah. world, how that's shifted things.
Yeah. Well, thank you for bringing that up. I'm curious if those eras of compassion, could you resonate with that through your career?
Absolutely. I mean, I think they lined up perfectly with like all the various different initiatives that I was working on. I mean, I was very much immersed in the mindfulness and well-being space within the organizations that I was working in. And it was uncanny to me, like the way that you kind of demarcated those different periods and times. And I could see like, oh yeah, this is when I was working with this team. And around this period of time, I was working with this team and had struggles here. And I had budget here, but didn't have support here. You know, like it was very, very interesting to watch that chart.
Yeah. Well, these five eras of compassion, can I frame it as what has been the relationship between compassion in corporate America or the corporate world, even outside of the US, and where did it play? And, you know, and it started as kind of the mindfulness meditation, remember Jon Kabat-Zinn, really starting to bring in Eastern philosophies into wellness, but it was a personal thing. And then we started realizing there are health benefits, and science was starting to teach that. And I was lucky enough to be in the mind, body, spirit kind of integrated behavioral medicine world, bringing some of that newest research into the work with patients that had chronic relapsing, just wellness conditions that couldn't be treated by traditional medicine. But then starting to bring it into the workplace as corporate wellness programs was a whole another thing. But then you bring in the whole inclusion, diversity, equity, belonging, that whole thing, which started to really build up steam right before pandemic. Mm-hmm. And now we're seeing a very interesting thing that's going on with DEI. Mm-hmm. But if we keep going, this whole idea of inclusion, I think, needs to be connected to compassion, because the post-pandemic world is talking about belonging, inclusion, cultures of thriving and flourishing. And what does that look like? And I think pre-pandemic, we could get by with defining compassion as just kindness or empathy in action. But now we can't, because compassion now has to have teeth. It has to address the accountability issues, because companies can't compete unless they can attract and retain really good people, unless they have thriving cultures that people want to work with, unless they provide coaching and mentoring, unless work is an extension of my identity, not just something I go to every day. So when we look at how work is changing, you can't accomplish that and compete without compassion and accountability. So I think we're really having, that is the next generation of what compassion means. It has to have it.
Yeah. And I imagine too, I'm kind of curious your thoughts on this, like with younger generations, you know, I'm Gen Xer myself, but I think millennials and Gen Z tend to have a different awareness of the importance of these things. And they have different boundaries and non-negotiables when it comes around to like what type of work environment that they want to work in. Like, how do you see like the shift in these younger generations and like the norms of behavior and the norms of needs within organizations shift when, in relationship to like compassion and accountability?
I'll share with you a really specific, personal, real example. So my old middle daughter just graduated with her master's in clinical psychology, and she's going out in the workplace. And last fall, we were in her, where she was, we stayed the night in her apartment, and we were hanging out with a bunch of her friends. We went out. We were going to do one last fling, a little bar hopping with all her friends in her college town before she graduated. We had a great time. But at the end of the evening, we were back at her apartment, all yucking it up. We'd had a couple of drinks. And the topic came up of what I do for a living. And somebody was like, yeah, so what do you do, Emily's dad? And I said, I help build cultures of compassion and accountability. And the room got silent. And people were like, say more. Yeah. And as I started to explain it, these 23, 24, 25-year-olds that were in their first jobs were like, oh my gosh, you're describing the world I want to live in. Mm-hmm. And right now, here's why I hate my job. Here's why this old school company, blah, blah, blah. And so they were 100% resonating. And they're like, where can I get your book? And so that felt really encouraging, because there's a table in the book that describes what it used to be like and what it is like now. And they were totally fitting it, and they want it.
It creates a lot of optimism for me. You know, you have these newer folks coming in, they're going to hold leadership and management accountable to make sure that these work environments are safe and healthy and create thriving environments where everybody can be successful. And you mentioned two words that I think are really, really poignant here, this idea of inclusion and belonging. And to me, like so much of what goes kind of sideways within the workplace and what really needs improvement within the workplace is exactly that, like creating environments where people can feel a sense of inclusion and belonging. Yep. And I wonder, you know, from your perspective and the work that you've done, when you introduce compassion and accountability, how does that shift things for folks in terms of belonging and inclusion?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because we don't put ourselves out there to be experts in this field of diversity or inclusion, belonging, because that is a pretty specific thing. It has legal ramifications, policy ramifications. But what we're getting is more people calling us and saying our inclusion or diversity efforts have stalled out. Mm-hmm. We've hit a wall and we don't know what to do. And what we've realized is they approach this with good intentions, but only with the value switch on. Mm-hmm. And so when we start looking at what the capability and responsibility switch looks like, it's like, the reason we've stalled out is because we haven't focused on building people's capacity. We haven't focused on the logistics of what it means to thrive. And when we haven't looked at responsibility for behavior, and we have pretended that removing conflict is somehow a success. But what we haven't done is learned how to do conflict with our switches on. And so now all of a sudden we're into our sweet spot, which is, how do you actually have the hard conversations that affirm value, capability, and responsibility when you disagree? Because diversity is part of the grand design of the universe. We're different on purpose, and that means we're going to have conflict. So let's get ready for it instead of trying to define success as somehow the absence of conflict. That's not at all. Conflict is the grist. It's the energy. It's the electricity behind the switches.
Ah, man, I'm glad you mentioned that too. You know, because it seems like over the last many years, that was so much of the effort that I was witnessing, was like, let's make it as frictionless as possible. Let's like make sure everyone feels like, you know, they're as comfortable as they can possibly be. And like, let's not ruffle feathers as much as we can. And I think what that did is it swung the pendulum too far the other direction, where people are just afraid to have difficult conversations, and they're afraid to just, you know, be themselves because they don't want to hurt people's feelings, or they don't want to cause, you know, ripples or waves within the work culture. And, you know, I wonder, you know, since the pandemic, and since, you know, we all went through this pretty intense experience of, you know, going, working remotely, and now we're coming back to the office, and we're having to like relearn what it means to be in community with people.
Right.
Like, how are you seeing this like unfold, and where are you seeing it maybe like kind of bubble up to the surface, where we need even more compassion and accountability for this to really be successful?
Yeah, we saw it. We saw it about a year, 6 months after the things had kind of stabilized. You know, people were like, all right, you know, it's time to get back to serious. We got to get serious. It's not anything goes. It's no working in your pajamas anymore. It's like, we don't even know what you do at home. And that was all fine at first, but now we got to focus. So the pendulum just hammered to the other side. It's like all accountability now, documenting your work. You got to come back to work. And then all of a sudden there were two camps. It's like, force people to come back to work, or just continue letting them do whatever they want. And neither one is a solution, because we know we need community. We need that time and space together. And so now we're having to grapple with this. How do we focus on the highest standards of excellence and competitiveness while creating an environment where people feel safe, they feel excited, they're curious, they feel high levels of ownership and pride and accountability for their behavior all at the same time. And so that's why the book subtitle is called How Leaders Build Connection and Get Results. It's really, they happen at the same time.
Yeah. And I'm curious too, you know, in terms of like this idea of operationalizing compassion within the workplace, how does that really work? You know, you mentioned this idea of like on the day to day, like putting these things into practice and making work, like, you know, showing up to a meeting, or like maybe it's a difficult conversation that a leader has to have with one of the reports. Like, how does that actually work in practice?
Yeah, well, let's jump ahead to, this is not in the book, but it's part of our actually on the ground in the trenches training. This concept of ORPO, it's a 4-part formula for having those tough conversations. And it's called open, resourceful, persistent, open. Openness is about where we affirm human value, that it is safe. We disclose our feelings. We affirm and validate others' feelings. R is about problem solving. It's like, what are the resources? What do we have to work with here? Persistence is about keeping the most important thing the most important thing. So whether it's boundaries, standards, apologizing when you mess up. And then the last open is about reconnecting at a human level. So let's say that you and I got a beef, right? There's a famous movie, Beef, got a bunch of awards last night. So let's say you're an employee of mine and I've noticed a performance issue, maybe it's compromising our culture, whatever. And I'll go talk to you and I come to you and I say, Nicholas, I've been feeling really unsettled about something and I want to share it with you. Here's what I saw in our meeting the other day and the impact that I noticed. And I just wanted to bring that up to you. That's the resourceful part. I go to persistent and say, why this matters is because we have said we're aspiring to this kind of a culture. And I see that behavior as not consistent with that. And so I just want to check in with you. How are you doing with what we've gone through? ORPO. Now, I don't know how you're going to respond, but the whole point is I'm coming at you, starting conflict, literally, but we're both valuable. We're both capable and we're both responsible. There's no attack. There's no assumptions. There's no hierarchy being pulled. There's no threats or ultimatums, and there's no backing down. So we teach that template. How would you use that in every single situation that you had to deal with? And how would we back it out and say, what if we conducted a meeting using that arc as the way that we handled the meeting? And what if we addressed every single agenda item with the very same arc? So we always know where we stand. We are always reinforcing our core values every time we communicate.
Yeah, I think the things that I heard in that flow, which really stood out to me. I mean, first of all, like I was already disarmed as soon as you started talking about that. Like, you started with an I statement. You started with like talking about like what the impact was on for you of yours, and then you started talking a little bit about what you were noticing, as opposed to saying like, here is the fact or a thing that's happening. I mean, that to me sounds a lot like, was it like nonviolent communication or compassionate communication? Is that kind of the core of that?
There we borrow, you know, we've done so much research on everything from nonviolent communication, you know, a lot of psychological, social psych principles. There's radical candor. There's so many. There's crucial conversations. And we've looked at all of those. And then we've also gone back to the science and the research and said, what really are the fundamental components? And how do we do that? And so with ORPO, it really checks all the boxes and doesn't leave people hanging. Some of the other ones, they're all great. Whatever you have, use it. I'm not trying to, you know, throw anyone under the bus, but what we found is about 97% of people that work with this template say it works better than anything I've ever used because it picks up a loose end, or it reminds me of this that I was leaving before, or it helps me know when to focus on me and when to focus on the other person. So keeps us on the straight and narrow.
Yeah. And underneath all of that, I'm interested too in like the mechanics of that. Like, why does that work so well? You know, because even as you were sharing that with me, like, even though I'm not technically like, we're not working for you, you're not a manager of mine. Like, even as you were talking about that, I felt my nervous system kind of just settle, you know, where I think in another incident, you know, if somebody were to come to me and be like, hey, here's this problem that we're encountering, this is what you're doing wrong. It's like, suddenly there's tension there.
Yeah. And interestingly, I actually told you that, but I didn't tell you that first. And ORPO, we've researched that with thousands and thousands and thousands of case examples, and that's the order that works. It's the only order that works. If I did it the other way around and I came and said, okay, so I noticed some things in the meeting that were inconsistent with our values, I'm feeling a little bit unsettled. It's like, doesn't work well. And so we have thousands of case examples of why it doesn't work when you start any other way, and that's why it's so effective. But the other thing is, you know, at Open, I used the strategy of disclosure. I shared with you my feelings with an I statement. But let's say you came to me all freaking out about something a colleague said, right? And you're expecting me to somehow fix it. Typical HR challenge. And what if I said to you, what if instead of disclosing my own feelings, I said, Nicholas, I get it, man. It is so frustrating when these things kinds of happen. You aren't crazy. And then I went to resourceful and said, will you share a little bit more about what happened? Because I want to be a resource for you to solve it. But then I go to persistent. I said, and here's the bottom line though. I'm not going to do it for you, but I'm willing to support you to do it yourself. And then I check back in and say, how does that sound? So that's a situation where it's not about me. You're the one coming in and I'm saying your experience is valid. You're real. You're not crazy now, but you're also part of the solution and you also are responsible for your behavior. I'm not going to fix this for you. So we teach three strategies at each of the turning points in this arc, and each strategy has a particular time when you would use it and a time when you wouldn't. So it gives you options.
And I'm interested too, Nate, you know, where when you see people kind of trying to adopt this and bringing this into practice, like where do you see people like struggle, and where do you see it like become like a difficult process for people to adopt?
By far, openness is the most challenging. It is what's missing in leadership. And what we've noticed is the higher you go up in leadership, the more openness the value switch is the one that people stop paying attention to and don't know how to do. Mm-hmm. Vulnerability, affirmation, talking about feelings, being able to be just present. You know, the conversation you and I had right before we started recording about what we're each doing to take care of ourselves, that's not a conversation most leaders feel comfortable having. Mm-hmm. That's vulnerable. That's weak. That's personal. So that's where the weak, that's where this problem is. The mm-hmm. second problem we find is newly promoted leaders have a struggle with the capability switch because they want to take on work for other people. They want to do it for them and show them how to do it. They don't know how to have the fine line between struggling with people where both parties are becoming more capable. Mm-hmm. And then the third challenge is persistence. Leaders struggle with how to set boundaries without ultimatums, without attacking, without caving, without blaming, without threats. It's really a challenge, and they get desperate to get results. And so they fall off the wagon right there.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, to me, it sounds like this should be like required reading and required training for just about any manager, whether they're a new manager or a seasoned practitioner. When you work with folks and when you're helping them adopt these new processes, are there aha moments or light bulb moments that go off for them that allows them to suddenly like get it and be able to put this into practice?
Yeah, you know, people when they're learning something new and it's uncomfortable, they often want to talk about it instead of do it. So they'll be asked more and more clarifying questions. And finally, we're like, we're not going to field any more questions until you've actually written an ORPO for a real situation. And it's excruciating, and they do it. And all of a sudden, and then they read it to the group. And it's mm-hmm. like, you can just see like their mind shift just sets. Like just shifts. It's like, you mean I could actually have this conversation and it would be way more effective than what I've done before. And you can see things open up. And then we do a lot of coaching with people where they'll email us an ORPO statement, like what I just shared with you, and said, I'm working, I got to talk to somebody, but I want some help. And we coach them through it until we're happy with it. They're happy with it. And then they go deliver it and they report back, and people are just ecstatic. They're like, where has this been all my life? Like, it just unlocked all this energy in this relationship. I didn't know how to do conflict. I thought that that was the thing to be avoided. Now I can walk into it as a creative force mm-hmm. That actually builds our relationship and builds trust. But it's hard until you start doing it.
You got to do the work. Yeah. And I imagine too, like this type of work probably impacts folks across other domains of their life as well, even outside of the workplace. I mean, as you're talking about these things, I'm thinking about my own relationship with my wife. I'm like, this would be hugely helpful in day-to-day conversations. Is that something that you notice as well?
Oh my goodness. You know, I'm a recovering clinical psychologist. So I come from a lot of training in behavioral transformation and for just personal effectiveness, just relationships in general. So we feel like if a company is going to bring training resources or support to their employees, it should help them in every aspect of their life. It should be a life skill. And so that's what we're trying to do. Just recently I was talking to someone in charge of a whole bunch of training for a big company. And he had been through our course and he came back and said, I just have to tell you, it's already changing my relationship with my daughter, who's 13. And we have these intractable conflicts that are 13-year-old stuff between a dad mm-hmm. and a kid. And all of a sudden I'm just talking to her. Like, I have a tool for doing it. And yeah, we'll talk about training our people later, but it's changing my personal life. And if you think about employees, if you can help them change their personal life, they come to work more energized. They come to work feeling like a better person. Mm-hmm. They come to work feeling grateful for the gift you've given them. And they want to stay attached to that.
And imagine the ripple effect of that just goes on and on and on. Like when employees feel like they're being seen and heard and supported, they're able to do more effective work. They're more productive. The business is more successful and on and on and on.
Well, I mean, the old abuse, when I used to work in the field of domestic violence, the whole idea is, you know, dad goes out and gets drunk and hits mom, and then mom hits the kid, and then the kid kicks the cat, and mm-hmm. the cat eats the mouse. You know, what if you could reverse that? Think of the ripple effect. If dad comes home and affirms the value of his partner, and the partner treats the cat differently, and the cat doesn't hide when dad walks home. It's just like you could just change the world one conversation at a time.
That's powerful work. So Nate, I'm interested too, you know, so you've got this book out, you're doing trainings, like what comes next? Like where does this whole train take you in the next few years? And how do you see that evolve within the workplace?
Scaling. I our mission at Next Element is to bring compassion to every workplace. And so every day we wake up thinking, how can we scale? And that requires disconnecting the impact from our own time and effort. It can't be reliant on a training program. It can't be reliant on face-to-face necessarily. So we're exploring all kinds of different ways to bring this behavioral technology into workplaces. So we're going to be rolling out cultural assessments like culture scans, where we can help assess organizations for where their switches are and what do they need to do. We do certification programs so we can equip internal L&D people culture and HR to just scale this and bring it to everybody. And then we're also just launching an executive training course based on the book, where we take leaders through that and help them implement it in their culture.
No, that's fantastic. And if folks are interested in learning more about this, or if they want to get involved with compassion and accountability themselves as a leader, or even just as someone who's interested in the topic, what's the best way to for people to find you?
I would say the best thing is just type in compassionateaccountabilitybook.com and you'll get to us. And my name, Nate Regeer, you can find me on LinkedIn, and even the phrase compassionate accountability, you'll find it associated with a lot of things we've written, books, blog posts, podcasts like this one.
That's great. And Nate, just as we close up, you know, as you kind of think about what needs improvement within the modern workplace, mm-hmm. I'm kind of curious if you have any thoughts top line, if there's like one or two big things that could really move the needle the farthest for organizations to make places that we work at more happy and healthy places to be. What would you say that was?
Here's what needs improvement. Brand is a lagging indicator of the quality of our culture. You cannot manufacture a brand. You can't hire a fancy agency to create your brand, because if your culture sucks, your brand sucks. But what's culture? Culture is the sum of every interaction. So the action is in the interaction. And when our interactions happen with compassion, accountability, the culture will thrive and the brand will be awesome. So what needs improvement is focus on the quality of our individual interactions every single day at every level to make sure our switches are on.
I love it. I think that's a lesson that we can all take to heart. Nate, thank you so much for the work that you're doing out there in the world. Thank you for helping make the world a world of work a better place. We'll definitely link for folks links to your website and to your book in the show notes below. Folks, if you're interested in learning more about Nate, definitely check out his book, Compassionate Accountability. I highly recommend it. And stay tuned. We'll have more episodes of the Needs Improvement Podcast in the coming months and more guests like Nate. If you have other topics that you'd like to hear more about, feel free to let us know and take care of yourselves out there. Thanks so much. Nate, you have a wonderful afternoon, and thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. And for the great work you're doing with this podcast and for the Changing Work Collective, it's just an incredible difference you're all making.
I really appreciate that. Thank you so much. All right, that's a wrap for today's episode of the Needs Improvement Podcast. If our conversation resonated with you, do us a favor, share this episode with your network. We'll be back next month diving even deeper into what needs improvement in the modern workplace. Until then, take what you've learned and make your workplace a better place to be. See you soon.